I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and here's what we concentrate on this hour. Our guest has, since 2005, tracked the rate of election litigation, how often plaintiffs go to court to fight over election rules, and his latest research demonstrates that election litigation in the 2016 election season was up 23% over 2012. He also writes in a recent issue of the New York Times that by 2020, cyber attacks could try to alter or erase voter registration databases, bring down our power grids, mess with our transportation infrastructure, or do something else to interfere with actual voting on election day. We've been asking the question for some months now, what's being done about that? Our guest this hour is an election expert. Richard Hassan is Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California Irvine School of Law. Rick is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation. He's written extensively in many publications, The Times, The Washington Post, Politico. He writes the election law blog. He's the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, and Plutocrats United, Campaign Money, the Supreme Court, and the Distortion of American Elections. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Hassan, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
On a very important topic. Let's start with this external threat. As we know, we have been informed by the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, all these intelligence agencies that Russia engaged in this very big effort to undermine our election process in 2016. I keep asking the question, Rick, and I don't really get an answer. What's being done to make sure that midterm elections or 2020 elections are not going to be substantially hacked?
Well, I think it's important to clarify what we mean by hacked. So we're not talking about someone going in and changing vote totals. We don't have any evidence of that going on. The evidence of what appears to have gone on in the last election was that perhaps Russians or others went into voter registration databases, downloaded information. There are at least some reports that in some places voter registration information was changed. And that was then caught by local election officials and fixed in time. So it's not exactly hacking the vote. I don't like that terminology because it sounds like someone's actually changing vote totals, but these are things that could affect the outcome of elections. So for example, if you could alter voter registration databases and people showed up to vote and they were not listed as eligible voters, that could cause some kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what's being done, we know that state and local election officials have been getting an offer of help from the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security, the federal agency, declared elections critical infrastructure, and that designation just, I think, allows the DHS to free up resources and offer help. There's been some resistance in some states that this is some kind of federal takeover of elections, but I do think that both the DHS as well as the Federal Election Assistance Commission, which is mostly an advisory body that helps with best practices for state and local elections and works on certifying voting machines, I think those groups as well as some private groups are looking at these issues and trying to make sure that things are done in a way that's going to be have better security for 2018 and 2020. I don't think it's going to be so easy. I don't know if you saw the report on CNN last evening that a hacker who was fooling around sent some phishing emails to people in the White House and got the head of cybersecurity to think that he was getting an email from the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and wrote back and offered his private email address. So some of what we need to do involves not just technically changing things, but educating people, including people at the top, that it's important to be careful how you answer emails, what attachments you open. One small gateway open, and you can have all kinds of problems.
Do you have confidence that Congress and the administration is taking this issue very seriously and making sure that we will have confidence in future votes?
Well, I think there are two different questions there. One is about public confidence, and I think public confidence depends not just on what happens from the president, but also what is happening on the state and local level. And I think that this issue has gotten people's attention. I think the media will be paying attention, and I hope that steps will be taken to ensure that these things don't happen. In terms of the president has himself made a number of inflammatory and unsubstantiated claims about voter fraud and about the system being rigged. And so I wouldn't look to the president himself. We could talk about that presidential commission as well, which I think actually is going to undermine confidence. But if you look at what the federal government's doing at DHS, that seems to be being done, at least so far, in a non-political way, offering help. And I do think that the FBI and DHS and other federal agencies are providing resources to state and local officials to try to help them deal with this threat.
When you say that in the last election, vote totals were not changed, is there a possibility, though, that the technology could become more sophisticated so they could do just that?
So you have to think about how our voting system works, and the important thing to recognize here is that the federal government, even for federal elections, does not require a certain kind of voting machinery. In most of the United States, including in Wisconsin, the voting machinery produces a piece of paper that can be recounted. So if you've used the optical scan machine, as most people do in Wisconsin, you fill out the ballot with a pencil. It gets run through a machine. It's possible that the software of that machine could be hacked. The way to make sure that doesn't happen is that you can do a hand recount of the paper ballots. And so one of the things that's been suggested, which seems to be a very sound suggestion, is that there should be post-election audits, random audits, to make sure that the vote totals that the machines announce what's on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm most concerned is in other places, such as in Georgia, parts of Georgia, where they use electronic voting machines that do not produce a piece of paper. Then if there's a problem with the vote totals in the machines, there's no way to do a recount other than to ask the machine to do the same thing over again. And I think at this point, given the dangers that we face, it would be very wise for Congress to pass a law that would provide financial incentives for those minority of jurisdictions that use electronic voting machines that don't produce a piece of paper to phase those machines out. And that way we can all be confident that we at least have a paper record that we could check in the event that there is some concern about the machines that are used to count the paper ballots.
Why don't we just use pieces of paper to vote?
Well, we could just use a piece of paper, and we do in lots of places. We mark them with a pencil. If we didn't, you'd be waiting weeks for election results. And I think human beings counting out those paper results when you have so many elections in the United States, so many offices up for grabs, ballot measures in a lot of places, lots of things being voted on, it could take weeks, and it would likely be more error-prone than running them through the machines. So you can use the machines, have the paper backup, and do audits to make sure that the machine totals match the paper.
Mm-hmm. What about some states are doing, Oregon, I know, vote by mail, voting online, maybe that would be problematic, but what about vote by mail? What's a better system?
Well, I think vote by mail raises different concerns. So with vote by mail, it's still a piece of paper. That paper has to be counted. That paper is going to probably be put through a machine. And then you still need to do the audit. So vote by mail doesn't solve that problem. It deals with other issues, such as, for example, people who might have trouble getting to the polling place, people who might not be able to vote on election day in states like Pennsylvania or New York, where there is no early voting unless you have some valid excuse for being out of town. The problem with vote by mail, not a problem that we've seen in Oregon or Colorado where they use it, but a problem that could come up in other parts of the country, is that when you use absentee ballots freely, there is the danger that absentee ballots could be bought and sold. So we have had those kinds of problems of fraud in elections. Voter fraud is very rare, but when it does happen involving voters, the most common by far type of fraud is absentee ballot fraud, where people buy and sell ballots. And the reason it's more prevalent with absentee ballots is simply that you can verify how someone voted.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to pay you $20 to vote for a particular candidate and you're going to the voting booth, I have no way of knowing what you've done. That's one of the benefits of the secret ballot. But with a piece of paper out of the polling area, that does raise that concern. Again, no issues of fraud or coercion that we've seen on any in any significant way in places like Oregon, but there are other parts of the country which have a longer history of problems with absentee ballot fraud, where I would be concerned about moving to that kind of system.
Let's talk about this Election Integrity Commission that the president established. He says that, and you say these charges are outrageous and false, 3 million or more illegal voters in 2016. A couple questions here. This I wasn't aware of, that voters across the country, you say, have asked election officials to remove their names from voting rolls so that their personal information will not be turned over to this Election Integrity Commission. How widespread is that? And the second question, or the first question, is where does the president come up with these numbers? 3 million people voted illegally, really?
So there's a lot going on in that question. Let's back up to the November 2016 results. You may remember that the president won a narrow electoral college victory, thanks to Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Those were three surprise states there that put him over the top. But he lost the popular vote by about 3 million votes. Before the election, the president was claiming there was a problem of massive voter fraud, and the kinds of fraud he was talking about was impersonation fraud, where one person's going to the polling place claiming to be another. That kind of fraud almost never happens. I've been looking for it for decades, and we really can't find any elections anywhere in the United States where this kind of fraud has been used to try to swing an election. After the election, the president switched his rhetoric about voter fraud, in part based on some completely unsubstantiated claims made by a gentleman in Texas, saying that 3 to 5 million non-citizen voters voted in our elections. There's no good evidence, and this person who's made this claim has refused to release any evidence to support this claim. The claim has the benefit of explaining, in the president's mind, why he may have lost the popular vote. In fact, in an interview with ABC News right after the election, not only did he claim that there were millions of fraudulent voters, but he said all of those votes went for Hillary Clinton. Not a single one went to him. Not one, was what he said. So I think this commission is meant to validate his concerns about voter fraud. And I think what it's likely to produce, given who is on the commission, it's a very unbalanced commission, and we could talk about that, is a report that will claim that even if there is not massive voter fraud, there is the potential for voter fraud, and that should cause states and perhaps the Congress to pass laws to make it harder for people to register to vote. What we know about what's actually happened in terms of how many non-citizens have voted so far, I think there have been 30 plausible cases that have been found by the Brennan Center across the country. 30, not 300, 3,000, 30,000, 300,000, 3 million.
Who's on the commission, Rick?
So I should say that we've had election commissions before. The structure of them has been pick two elder statesmen, one from the Democratic Party, one from the Republican Party, to serve as co-chairs, bring in election officials from around the country, and bring in election professionals. So we've had a President Carter, President Ford Commission, President Carter, Secretary of State James Baker Commission. The last commission that we had in 2012 was a commission headed by Bob Bauer, who was the White House counsel and Obama's lawyer, and Ben Ginsburg, who is a well-respected Republican lawyer and Mitt Romney's general counsel. This commission is headed by Vice President Pence, who, of course, is going to be running for office, he's already announced, for the vice presidency in 2020. The vice chair, the person who appears to be doing all of the work, is a controversial person named Kris Kobach, who's the Secretary of State of Kansas. He's the only prominent election official I know who has said that the president's claim of millions of fraudulent voters could be correct. He has been at the forefront of arguing that non-citizen voting is a major problem. He's been involved in a number of lawsuits against the ACLU and the League of Women Voters about things he's trying to do in Kansas. I think he's lost four or five of those cases before the federal courts. He was sanctioned a couple of weeks ago by a federal court in one of these pieces of litigation for misleading the court in explaining what documents he had that he was holding that he was going to be giving to President Trump about what should happen with the changes to federal voting laws. And so he's the vice chair, and then there are other people on that commission who have a long reputation, some of whom I wrote about in my 2012 book, The Voting Wars, a long reputation for making false and exaggerated claims that voter fraud is a major problem. So there's more of those people, more Republicans than Democrats on the commission. Only two of the Democrats have any kind of national stature on the commission, one of those two. Secretary of State of New Hampshire is not really considered much of a Democrat. And so it's an unbalanced commission with, I think, some preconceived ideas about what it's going to do, despite the claim that they're just going to take the evidence where they found them. Now, in terms of what they're doing, Kobach sent out a letter asking every state to turn over all publicly available voter information, including, if it's allowed, and he listed people's names, addresses, last four of their Social Security number, their partisan affiliation, date of birth, etc. Many states refused to turn this over. There have been some lawsuits so far unsuccessful to try to stop it. They've now sent out a new letter. The information was potentially going to be sent in by email, which would be insecure. And as you mentioned, and some voters are so concerned about this.
Oops, hello. Oh, dear. Well, we lost his line there somehow, so we'll try to reestablish our connection and pick up with what it is that some voters are doing because they're so concerned about the information that might be going to this commission. Rick Hassan is our guest this hour, Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science, University of California, Irvine School of Law, author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, Plutocrats United, Campaign Money, the Supreme Court, and the Distortion of American Elections, a piece that he wrote on July 15th, made us think this would be a good show. Don't let our democracy collapse. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We'll pick up his thought and start taking phone calls from you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Rick was in the middle of talking about how some voters have responded when it comes to giving personal information to the election commission. We'll get his response, and then we have tons of phone calls coming in, so we'll go to your phone calls. I'm sorry, we lost you in mid-sentence, Rick.
Yeah, sorry about that. So I was talking about how some voters were upset about their voter information being taken away from them or being handed over to this commission without potentially proper safeguards for the information. And I think the latest figure I saw in Colorado was that 5,400 voters had asked to be removed from the voting rolls so that their information would not be turned over. Now, whether those people signed back up again, I don't know. Kobach has said this was a stunt for voters, or maybe said they were illegal voters who were trying not to get caught. It doesn't seem like that is accurate. But we'll see what happens once some states turn over this information. It's voluntary. There's no requirement that they do it. Kobach himself declined to turn over information to his commission the first time because it did not comply with Kansas law. We'll see what he does the second time around. Secretary of State Dunlap, who's the main Secretary of State, who's the other prominent Democrat who's on the commission, has said he's not going to turn things over. And he has argued that he's going to be on the commission and will push to make sure that the commission gets pushback if it claims that voter fraud is a major problem. We'll see how he does on this commission.
Lots to talk about. We'll continue. We want to go to some phone calls. And Maurice in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Maurice.
Hi. I'm wondering on which stone tablet it's been written that everything has to be on the Internet. There was a day before the Internet. In fact, almost all of history, there was no Internet. So when there's vote counting free of the internet, it can't be hacked. And I might add that I use a landline, which doesn't glitch out when I'm on the radio. So I'm free of the internet by phone, too, and it's cheaper.
Should we be free of the internet, Rick?
Well, you know, these machines that are used to count votes are often not hooked up on the internet, but they do use software. And there have been some hackers who've shown to try to show the insecurity of these things that you can put in a thumb drive or you can do something. In some instances, you can wirelessly make changes to the software. So it's not just about the internet. It's about using any kind of computerized system. And I think short of what you suggested earlier, which is that we go back to human beings counting ballots by hand, which raises the danger of mistakes and also the potential for fraud when people are counting ballots by hand, and would certainly delay things. I don't think this is avoidable. I think that, as I said, the best solution which people have come to is the combination of paper receipts that can be recounted and post-election audits to make sure that the machines were not hacked, as well as doing things obviously proactively to make sure that our voting rolls are not being messed with.
Thanks, Maurice, for the call. Madeline in De Pere, hi.
Hi. I'd like to get some guidance about how is it hard to get off the rolls and then get back on again later? I think I'm going to want to do that because I don't trust our governor. And also, Kathleen, I think you're going to be, when you retire, you're going to be away from war without leave. I'm going to miss you.
Thank you. Thanks, Madeline, very much. I'll miss being here as well. So that's a good question. If you get off, can you get back on easily?
Every state's rules for how you register are different, but if you're an eligible voter, you should be able to get back on. I would suggest that if a person wants to get off the voting rolls, they should contact the Wisconsin Elections Commission, if they're a Wisconsin listener, and if not, if from another state, they would contact their state election officials and find out exactly what the steps are that need to be taken. I don't know that it's necessary, but I certainly understand, given the lack of trust people have in this commission, why some people feel that it's that they don't want this information shared. One of the things that happened at the very beginning was that the commission opened up for public comment to anyone who wanted to comment about what the commission was doing. And there were a number of people who sent in emails saying, I don't think you should be collecting personal information. I don't want my personal information shared. And then those letters with these people's personal information were posted on the White House website.
Oh, no.
And that was before, I think there was at least a week period before they were warned that whatever they sent in could then be publicly posted. So, the commission has not given people, I think, confidence that their privacy is going to be adequately protected.
You have tracked since 2005, which is a long time, the rate of election litigation, plaintiffs going to court to fight over election rules, and found that election litigation in the 2016 election season up 23% over 2012. What's the nature of the litigation?
Well, there's all kinds of litigation. So I've actually looked in the period before the disputed 2000 presidential election. Remember, that was the Bush versus Gore time.
Mm-hmm.
From the pre-2000 to the post-2000 period, election litigation has more than doubled. But we've had this new spike. So I think the initial doubling from pre-2000 to post-2000 comes from the fact that we've learned that in very close elections, the rules of the game matter. And so that has led to legislators and election officials, often election officials are partisan election officials, changing election rules in ways that could benefit one side or the other. That sometimes then prompts litigation. And I think in Wisconsin, as you know, you've had a lot of litigation, for example, over redistricting and
yes.
voter identification laws. These are part of the cases that are in my database. These are cases that... when there's one party that's doing something and the other party is objecting and is changing election rules, it provokes litigation now more than ever. And it provokes multiple litigation. And so if you think about the Wisconsin redistricting or the Wisconsin voter ID litigation, there was not just one suit over these. There were multiple suits over both of these. And, of course, those suit over the gerrymandering, the partisan gerrymandering, is going to the Supreme Court next year. So one-sided election rules provoke more litigation, and that's what I think we're seeing.
Nate in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thank you. I was going to bring up two false claims and one real one. You actually just touched on the real one, where the gerrymandering cases about elections being decided around voters rather than by voters. The two fake situations I was going to point out, one, Chris Kobach himself was involved with CrossCheck, which basically claimed that two different people with two different last names but similar two different middle names but similar last names in two different states were actually the same person double voting. A state actually tried using this and found it was wasting a lot of time because when it checked, these were actually two separate people, and what Chris was doing was basically spreading falsehoods. Different falsehood was that illegal immigrants or immigrants were voting illegal in California. And the thing is, California does give a driver's license to immigrants so it can keep track of them and enforce road rules, but those licenses have a phrase very clearly on them to show that this person's not a citizen, and any election official in California just has to look at it and should be able to tell that this is somebody who's not able to vote.
Rick.
Yeah, so let me respond to the second point on cross-check, because that's a term we haven't talked about, but it's worth talking about. So we don't have a national registry of all eligible voters in this country. We do it instead state by state. And in the last decade, there have been two efforts to try to have states cooperate with each other and remove duplicate voters from the rolls. So say you lived in New Jersey and then you moved to Florida, you might not get removed from the voting rolls in New Jersey. And so if Florida and New Jersey cooperate, then New Jersey will know to remove you. That's the idea. How you do this matching in order to clean your voting rolls makes a great deal of difference. There are two ways to, there have been two different programs that have been put out to try to deal with this. One is a program through the Pew Charitable Trust, which I think is considered to be very good, called ERIC, and that has enabled states to clean things up pretty well. The other one, the one that's more controversial, was started by Secretary Kobach, and it's called CrossCheck. And it uses looser criteria for figuring out who is a match. So, for example, it might match people just by last name, first name, without a middle initial. And people might have the same birthday. And there was one study out of Stanford that said that for every eligible voter that CrossCheck would properly flag to be removed, it would improperly flag 200.
Oh, my goodness.
So a 99.5% error rate. That's the only study I've seen. I don't know if that figure itself is accurate, but I think it's generally thought that the cross-check standards are much lower than the ERIC standards, meaning many more false positives, meaning a greater risk of disenfranchising people. And, of course, being registered in two states is not illegal. It's voting in two states in the same election, which you can't do. And there's no question our voting rolls need to be cleaned up. But what hasn't been shown is that the bloat in our voter rolls, which does need to be cleaned up, is leading to people voting on a massive level across states. It's just, again, does it happen? Yes. But it seems to be pretty rare, at least from the careful studies that I've seen.
Nate, thanks for your call. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I had a question or comment from your guest. It strikes me that for the last 5 to 10 years, we've been listening to grossly false allegations or exaggeration about voter fraud in order to politically pass voter restriction laws that affect people without driver licenses, which are oftentimes the poor who often vote Democratic. And it reminds me of the campaign for the last 25 years that we've heard about lame street liberal media bias to justify the now common term fake news to discredit factual information that people don't want to hear. I see this political analogy. And my last question is, weren't there false voter purging of alleged convicted felons that affected the 2000 Florida vote that ultimately helped elect George Bush? I'd be interested in his comments.
Thanks, Jim.
So in 2000, there was a controversial voter purge There were many felons. There were many people who were tagged as felons who were removed from the voting rolls incorrectly. That's because the company that the Florida Secretary of State hired to do the purge used loose criteria, and people with similar names and birth dates were taken off the rolls. At the same time, we know that there were a number of felons who were actually able to vote in the election because of other problems with how the election administration was done. And so, you know, this has been a problem that has been around for a while. It's really hard business to accurately keep our voting rolls clean. And if you do it in one way, you might leave on people who shouldn't be on there. You do it another way, you have a real risk of disenfranchising eligible voters. I should add that I just received an email from the public information officer at the Wisconsin Elections Commission, who tells me that the Wisconsin, you cannot remove your name from the voting list. You can only go from active to inactive status, but the name cannot be removed.
Okay. Somebody was listening from there. That's good. Let's talk about how partisan this issue has become. You mentioned how judges have been increasingly divided along party lines when it comes to appeal of voter ID and other restrictive measures. Has it always been, and of course, when it comes to states, too, Republican states seem to be more amenable to voter ID, et cetera, shortening the amount of days that you can vote. Why is this so darn political, and has it always been so political, Rick?
Well, the idea that states might pick voting rules to help the people in power is not a new idea, but I do think that we really saw, since the 2000 election, a rise in one-sided election rules being passed for party advantage. So you have the emergence of what I've called red state election law, places like Wisconsin, North Carolina, places with Republican legislatures, passing laws making it harder to register and vote, blue states like California, passing laws like automatic voter registration, making it easier to vote. The calculation on both sides seems to be that those voters who are least likely to vote, people who are poor, people of color, people who've moved, older people, tend to vote for Democrats, students, and these rules, restrictive rules, tend to make it harder for those people to register and vote. As to courts, I should be clear, I don't think that judges are making decisions consciously to help the political party from which they came, at least not the federal life tenure judges. But I do think they come with a certain worldview, and there's a reason that they were chosen because of the ideology that they have. And it happens that judges who were appointed by Democratic presidents in the federal courts seem to be much more concerned about issues of voter suppression than judges who were appointed by Republican presidents, who seem to be much more concerned about voter fraud. And it's probably just what they hear when they're listening to the radio or reading the newspaper about, you know, what their concerns are about how we run our elections. Mm.
And yet there are a basic set of facts here, aren't there? You just said that you look at 30 cases. Everybody knows, don't they know, that there isn't a whole lot of this fraud that takes place? Can't we look at this objectively?
Well, so take, for example, the question of voter ID laws and whether they're needed to prevent impersonation fraud. Justice Stevens, a Republican-appointed justice in the Supreme Court, who turned out to be very liberal in his later years on the Supreme Court, he was in a group of justices that voted to uphold Indiana's voter ID law and said maybe there could be follow-up litigation if there are people who face special burdens in getting these laws. But on the specific point that you raised, he said even if actual fraud is not a problem right now, it's a potential problem, and that potential is reason enough to allow the state to be able to take steps so that it doesn't become a big problem. And he cited to Boss Tweed in 1868 in New York. He cited to one possible voter impersonation case in 2004 in Washington State, really not very much evidence at all. But he, of course, grew up in Chicago during a time when Chicago elections were very corrupt.
Right.
And I think he worried about that. You know, err on the side of, you know, letting the state prevent the fraud versus err on the side of letting all eligible voters vote.
Mm. Our number is 800-486-8655. There are a couple lines open right now. Willem in Colfax, hi.
You know, as far as I agree with your what you were saying about the multiple studies finding very little evidence of voter fraud, which makes President Trump's assertion even more nonsensical. Either that, or I think this is the man who wrote the book, The Making of Donald Trump. If people would read that book, you would see that this is a strategy, if you want to call it that, that Donald Trump has followed his whole career. He makes these nonsensical, outrageous, bizarre statements, and then we react to it in some sort of a logical way, like let's study this issue. But there is, how does he know that 3 million fraudulent votes weren't cast for Hillary Clinton and he lost by the biggest landslide in American history? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And this, it's a pattern. He makes all these crazy sentences, like he's the most presidential, with maybe the exception of Abraham Lincoln, or you know, that Kelly, his new chief of staff, is going to be the greatest chief of staff in American history. I mean, I think at what point do the citizens say, this man is insane? You know, it's sort of like living in some sort of Kafka novel.
Rick.
Well, I can only speak to what he said about voting, and what he said about voting is unsupported by the evidence. I think I'll just leave that there.
And Ray in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Ray.
I'm surprised you haven't touched on this subject. You know, the thing about electronic voting and paper trails, that's one side of this coin. The other side of the coin is the process we use to decide who will be the nominees for both of these corrupt parties. Look at how long the primary takes. It starts in Iowa, it goes to New Hampshire. These are all white states. So if a person can get out in front in these all white states, they usually run the table. Not always, but usually. We need to get rid of that primary system. Have a single day, the whole country votes on the same day, one giant primary. And instead of having a two-year election cycle, let's have a 12-week election cycle.
What do you think about voter fraud? Do you think it exists, Ray?
That's a very good possibility, because I don't trust anything that goes into an electronic database personally. And now think, if Donald Trump and the Republicans are able to secure these voter registrations from across the country, imagine what kind of purge they could create with that. I mean, the whole system is completely broken. The democracy, we don't live in a democracy anymore.
All right, Ray. Rick. Take whatever
you
want of that.
I don't think that even if states turn over some of this information to the White House, that it's going to lead to voter purges, at least not directly, because states are the ones that have control over the election or registration rolls. So that's not going to happen. On the point about the primary system, I mean, that's a very different kind of concern, and there have been many proposals to change the primary system. One that I like is a rotating regional primary. We divide the country into four or six sections and have each area of the country, say the Southeast one year, the Northeast another year, the West, have primaries and spread them out over a few months. If you had one primary, think of how much money would be spent nationally. It would be incredibly expensive. That raises new concerns about who can run for office and what are they going to do in order to get all that money that they would need. There's also a benefit to the winnowing out process that comes over time. But that's a very different kind of concern than concern about the integrity of the election itself and whether or not votes are being fairly and accurately counted.
Thanks for your call, Ray. What's the status of this House move? I don't know where they are with this, to abolish the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Can you talk about what that does, and are they close to abolishing it?
The U.S. Election Assistance Commission was created by Congress after the 2000 Florida debacle. Congress passed something called the Help America Vote Act, which, among other things, provided money for voting machines to get rid of those hanging chads, which you may remember.
Yes, I do.
We're now at a new stage where we need more money to get new machines, to get rid of some of the problematic machines that are still out there. But the other thing that another thing that HAVA did was it created this advisory commission called the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, two Democrats, two Republicans, Right now it's missing a Democrat, so there are three members. It has very little power. It can certify voting machines, which then states can buy machines that are certified. It provides best practices. It studies election administration. It produces reports. It does some good things, and it seems to be an especially important kind of government agency right now as we're concerned about these issues of cyber hacking and the integrity of voter databases and all of that. The EAC, the Election Systems Commission, has been opposed for a long time by Republicans in states because they're worried about the federal government taking over elections. It's kind of a states' rights federalism issue. And for a number of years in Congress, Republicans in the House have argued that the EAC should be abolished. And most recently, about a month ago now, there was an appropriations bill that was going to abolish the EAC. In the last couple of weeks, it looks like that attempt has been abandoned, and actually money has been, in the latest iteration of the appropriation, the budget has been increased for the EAC. I think that's a very smart move, and I hope that that actually makes it all the way into whatever appropriation ultimately comes out of Congress.
Professor Richard Hassan is our guest this hour. He's a professor of law and political science, UC Irvine School of Law, a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation. He wrote a piece in the Sunday Review July 15, Don't Let Our Democracy Collapse, in which he looked at a number of issues, the external threat to our elections. He also looked at the number of people who have been concerned and raised concerns about election rules in various states and have gone to court, plaintiffs who have gone to court about that and many other issues. And we're covering as many as we can this hour and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is ideas at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your comments there. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to Twitter here for a moment. Karen writes, post-election audits need to be routine, not just when signs of miscount. We won't know of signs if we don't monitor for them.
I completely agree. And, I don't know if you remember right after the 2016 election, Wisconsin did do a full recount. It went better than the recount in Michigan, which ended up getting stopped. Mm-hmm. Michigan, there were tremendous problems in the Detroit area. And there was a later investigation. It revealed that it was a lot of human error in how poll workers were processing things, as well as some machine error. But that was in the context of a recount. But I agree that we should separate the audit from a recount. So even if it's not a close election, we should still be doing a check in every election. You don't have to recount every vote, but random checks to make sure that things are matching up, because that's just sound administration practice, and it will help bolster public confidence in the process.
Camille in New Berlin, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I worked as a special registrant deputy and registered people for the polls, and I also work at the polls giving out ballots. What I found was that those people who registered online, who appeared at the polling table, were not in the books and had to go back to the table to register. If we go to a system where you can't register the day of the election, how many people who were either purged or thought they registered but didn't register will be unable to vote if states pass laws that say you cannot register the day of? Or is there no way of telling what that number might be? And before I take your answer, Kathleen, it's like losing a dear friend. We're going to miss you.
Thank you, Camille. Thanks very much. I'm retiring next Thursday, in case you're wondering about these calls that are coming through, Rick. I don't know how many states have this. You can register on the day of voting, but that's an interesting question from Camille.
So some states have same-day voter registration. Much more common is you have to register 2 weeks before or mm-hmm. a certain number of days before. And the Supreme Court has said it can't be too long before, otherwise you start disenfranchising voters. It's certainly true that same-day voter registration is the most fail-safe for voters, in that if for some reason they failed to register or they've moved and their registration is somehow no longer valid, depending on the state's rules, that they could then re-register that day. I don't know what the numbers would be of what would be lost by moving to a longer period of registration, but certainly there would be some. I should point out, the caller mentioned online voter registration. This is a very good reform. This is one that Democratic and Republican states have been adopting, and I hope that more states will do it. It's not electronic voting. You're not voting for anyone, but it's just simply putting in your information or changing your information if you move right. for your voter registration card. The reason that's better than, you know, I don't know about your handwriting, but mine's pretty terrible.
So is mine.
If somebody has to read that card, and if you have a weird last name, weird spelled last name like I do, the chances that somebody who's doing data entry for the state is going to get it wrong are much higher than the chances of you typing your own name going to get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If your name's wrong, then you know you may have a problem voting. And so online voter registration is a great system. Everyone wants to be able to have that convenience. And as I said, Democratic and Republican states, led by places like Pew and the Bipartisan Policy Center and the last Presidential Commission on Election Administration, they're pushing these kinds of sensible, consumer-friendly ways of trying to make voting both secure and better. And I wish we were still in that phase. That really seems to be the way we could make things better.
Mm-hmm. Camille, thanks so much for your call. Ed in Bayfield, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Ed?
I'm great, thank
good.
You. Hey, I just would like to ask your guest what he thinks about the fact that you need to have identification to buy cigarettes, alcohol, get on the aircraft. You need to show identification to pick up your tickets at will call at a rock concert. So why would it be inappropriate to ask someone to have identification to pick the leader of the free world?
So I'd start by saying that you don't have a constitutional right to go to a rock concert, or maybe you do, but you certainly have a right to vote. And you know, so the question is, should you have to have some way of identifying yourself? Sure. I actually favor a national voter ID card. And national voter registration automatically conducted by the federal government. We're not there yet. The problem with voter ID as it's been implemented in places like Wisconsin, Texas, and North Carolina is that it's been too strict. So, you know, why can't you have a student ID card? You know, some states you can, some states you can't. Why is it that Texas, for example, chose to allow concealed weapons permits to be okay but not student IDs? When you have a narrow class of IDs and you don't have a way out, people who, for example, don't drive, don't have a passport, they're poor, they were born in another state, they don't have $23 to get a birth certificate, why should those people be disenfranchised when the chances of someone coming to the polls and impersonating someone else are extremely, extremely small? As I said, from the 1980s on, I can't find a single election where there's a scheme to steal an election through impersonation fraud. I think the best solution, if you're going to have ID, is to have a broad set of IDs and to have a backup. So, for example, if the person cannot produce the right ID because they don't have one of those forms, they should be able to sign an affidavit under penalty of perjury. This is who I am. And then they can always be investigated later, see if they're committing voter fraud. But people signing things under penalty of perjury, they take it seriously. That's a way to get around this.
Professor Hassan, we covered a lot of territory, and I thank you so much for all the work you're doing and for joining us this hour.
My pleasure, and good luck with the retirement.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Richard Hassan, Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California Irvine School of Law. The piece that he wrote we'll have on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. There's also a picture of Finn, the dog I'm getting in 2 weeks and one day, just counting down the days, who I'm going to raise to do therapy work. That's part of the retirement plan. Actually, he's on Facebook too. So the article and the dog on Facebook, it's good to see both the number, the places, the Kathleen Dunn Show. And our guest, Professor Hassan, has two books, The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, and Plutocrats United, Campaign Money, the Supreme Court, and the Distortion of American Elections. Thanks so much to Gretchen Brown for producing this program, and to Gretchen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee for your calls. I thank you. And stay with us. We are going to have a wide-ranging conversation with a wonderful writer, Ron Suskind, following the news.